It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll talk with a Madison-based researcher about the concept of planetary boundaries, or conditions that ensure the long-term sustainability of the human species, and the damage that humans may have already done to those boundaries.
First, Governor Scott Walker is set to deliver his budget address this evening. The two-year budget is expected to contain some pretty big cuts as the state faces a looming budget shortfall.
Among other things, Walker has already called for a $300 million cut to the University of Wisconsin system. He's also revealed plans to borrow about $1 billion to pay for transportation projects in the state. But what else should we be watching for tonight?
Here with us now is J.R. Ross. He's editor at wispolitics.com. J.R., welcome back to the show.
Thank you. How are you guys doing this afternoon?
I'm good. Well, I understand this afternoon you got a little more of a sneak preview than we've already gotten. Anything at this preview that we didn't know yet?
It was all embargoed, so I can't share yet.
Uh-oh.
But come back to wispolitics.com at 7 o'clock. It'll all be there, I promise.
Well, let's start with the big picture here. The budget shortfall, hearing a lot of big numbers being thrown around, $2 billion plus. What is the state really up against here?
Well, the $2.2 billion number is if you imagine your kid's Christmas wish, right? I mean, they ask for everything under the sun, and then you only give them a certain amount. Well, that's kind of like what the numbers are with our state budget. We are $2.2 billion short if you think of every state agency in Wisconsin asking for everything on their wish list that they want from the state. The real number is about $930 million, which is the problem. We are short that much to cover the services we currently provide in Wisconsin to the citizens that you have to cut. So UW, that's about a third of that problem taken care of right there. So that helps out a little bit with that regard. But what you're probably going to see from Governor Walker are, you know, a number of smaller cuts, if you will, a little bit of money here, a little bit of money there. After a while, it adds up to a decent-sized number. But he's going to talk about things like reforming state government, shrinking the size, making it more efficient, doing away with things that we've done for a long time that don't make sense anymore. He's, in one way, the Republicans look at this budget this way, that 4 years ago, they got the state's finances on the right track. 2 years ago, they cut taxes dramatically. This one kind of repositions the state of Wisconsin in their minds for another big tax cut in the next biennium when they expect the economy to take off. Now, Democrats are going to tell you, look, you're going to see no big increases in, you know, K-12 funding. You're going to see a big cut to UW. You're going to see a budget that Republicans basically put us in a situation because a year ago, they cut taxes by $900 million, which is about the size of our deficit right now, because they wanted a short-term political gain rather than thinking long-term about our future and positioning ourselves to invest in education, these other priorities. So those are the message you're probably going to hear from the address tonight.
Well, let's check out some of the things you laid out there. The university budget cut has gotten a lot of the press over the last week, about a 13% cut to the system over the next 2 years, $300 million, as you said, offering the university some flexibility in exchange. What are you looking for as far as fleshing out what the governor's already said about that?
Well, you know, how the authority is going to work, how quickly can UW folks, if, and it is a big if right now, they get the authority, how quickly can they use the flexibility to offset those cuts. Governor Walker has talked about the flexibility as the Act 10 for UW in his mind. He has pointed out that 4 years ago, schools raised all kinds of red flags about his collective bargaining changes, say, related to layoffs and giant cuts. Because of the cut in state aid combined with that, he says that, look, you know, they were able to ask for more from public employees for their pensions and health care and that offset these cuts and things are doing well. In his mind, UW could look at getting rid of things like shared governance, for example, and then require more of their employees to help offset the cuts. Now, if you're a UW official, that's kind of a sacred cow a bit of going for shared governance, so they don't want to go that route. They're also talking about how this is going to be a deep, painful cut. They're going to freeze tuition for the next 2 years for in-state undergrads, and then the question becomes, well, what happens in the future? I mean, in the immediate, you would think they're going to ask for a big increase in tuition on graduate students, professional students, out-of-state international students. I mean, there's no freeze proposed for them. They might try and get more money out of those folks. What happens 2 years from now with tuition in at UW system if they're granted authority and they've been under a freeze now? It'd be 2 years going on plus two more. What happens when that freeze goes away? Are you talking about a huge tuition increase? That's kind of the concern you hear from lawmakers, Dems, but also some Republicans as well, about what's the future going to look like at UW System if this stuff all occurs.
And you said if. This is all subject to going through the legislature, of course. Another issue we've been watching, transportation funding. There's been talk, do we increase gas tax, vehicle registration fee, other things? Looks like no, none of the above. Some borrowing to pay for roads and other transportation projects.
Look through it through two prisms, if you will. On the one, Governor Walker is loath to raise taxes. He's not been a big fan of doing that. He kind of hangs his hat on holding line on taxes. That's his calling card, if you will. So the idea of a gas tax increase already was not very palatable to him. Also add in the context of the presidential race. We all know Governor Walker is very seriously considering a run for president. To be quite honest, everybody in Madison thinks he's already in the race, if you will, even though he says he's still thinking about it. If he were to raise taxes right now and go to Iowa, for example, and campaign to conservatives there, look, I should be the next nominee for president. I just raised the gas tax by a nickel a gallon or whatever. That would not go over very well. So you, one, have his personal beliefs. You, two, have the political implications for Iowa, and there's that thing. The other side to look at is Governor Walker's been talking, and others, for a long time about how we have a funding problem in Wisconsin for roads. Cars getting more fuel efficient. That means the gas tax revenues are declining because we're using fewer gallons of gas. They did away with indexing, which automatically raised that tax about a decade ago, a little less than that. So what's the future look like for funding for roads? The problem is what Governor Walker is proposing does not fix the long-term problem in the transportation program. Now, I also have to tell you, the time I've been up here, you don't hear many lawmakers talking about cutting back on projects. They still want their pet project, you know, in their home district and that kind of stuff. So if we're not going to cut projects, you got to find another solution. Borrowing, while it takes care of the immediate problem, does not provide a long-term solution to funding roads in Wisconsin. It makes the problem actually worse going forward because if you think about it, it's like your credit card payment. If your credit card payment or your mortgage payment, if your mortgage is, let's say, a third of your monthly income for your family right now, if it went up to 40%, you got to cut something else, don't you? It's the same thing. If we're borrowing right now for roads and increasing that, there'll be less money to pay for other things without that because of that debt service payment you have to pay for the project. So that's a long-term problem as well.
Now, on the revenue side, as you mentioned, it doesn't sound like there will be tax increases probably in the budget. Any signals of tax cuts in this budget?
Governor Walker's talked about keeping property taxes on the current projection, trajectory, if you will, going forward. He, of all the taxes he likes to cut, the property tax is number one by far. He's very much focused on that. And you can assume in this budget that there will be some mechanism in place that will keep property taxes largely flat. Now, when you talk about largely flat, that we talk about this mythical medium-valued home. If you took all the homes in Wisconsin and threw them all in one big pot and figured out what was the one right in the middle, they always use that one. Well, what's the property tax bill look like? What's it worth? And what would happen by these policies? So there will be, you know, individual communities that have a slight increase or a bigger decrease or whatever, but generally speaking, property tax will be flat, maybe down by a few dollars over the next couple of years. And their hope is that state revenues pick back up in a couple of years. They can do something, you know, more dramatic, if you will, in taxes.
Now, the governor has talked about the things we've talked about and some others, the Milwaukee Bucks Arena, some other things. Are there any big gray areas that we have left, big parts of the budget that we haven't got an indication of where the governor's going to go tonight?
Yeah, if you remember, go back to that $900 million question, where does all the money come from? So we've got a third of it with the UW cut. Where does the rest of it come? You know, how do you account for that $900 million and get to that solution? We're all assuming there's going to be deep cuts in state agencies because that's where the driver of spending is. So where are they going to be? Are they going to be across the board? Are they going to be targeted? Will you see fewer services in Wisconsin? Will you see, you know, I don't know, the state get out of something it's been doing for years to stop doing it because, well, we don't need to do it anymore. Those are the things we're kind of looking for in tonight. And, you know, again, the presidential thing, this budget address will be different than what we've had before in Wisconsin because most time it's the governor talking to the state. Well, I can tell you that there have already been at least a couple of media credential requests for tonight's speech from national outlets. This is now an address not just to Wisconsin but to the rest of the country, because the national media will be watching to see what this guy who's studying this rising contender for the nomination, the GOP side, what does he say, what's his approach, how does he perform in the bright lights? So it's going to be a different kind of speech in that regard tonight, too.
Before I let you go, JR, a Republican majority is in both chambers of the state legislature. Do you see a lot of these things being slam dunks? Republican governor gets agreement from the legislature, or do you think there's going to be some serious debate on some of these things?
There's going to be some heartburn among Republicans about a couple of things. One, the level of bonding. I mean, doing the $1.3 billion for transportation, they're not really thrilled with that. Again, because you're increasing the future, you're committing more money in the future to paying off those bonds, there's less money for other things. So they don't like that part. The Bucks arena, there's already some rumbling. Well, if you look at the whole pie right now, there's $220 million from the state. There's, I think, $150 from the current Bucks owners, $100 million from former owner Herb Cole. Where is the money from Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee? That's a concern for them. They would like to see, if you will, local skin in the game to drive down how much the state is borrowing to cover that arena. So there's some things like that that I think they're really going to have an issue with going forward. But, well, the heart of Walker's budget, yeah, I mean, it'll probably get done. But there's other small things that they might tweak, if you will, and try and find ways to do it. The issue for them is, where do you find the money? Because if they want to decrease the amount of borrowing, they got to find money in the budget somewhere to knock that down. That's going to be difficult.
JR, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime. Have a great day.
That's J.R. Ross, editor at wispolitics.com, with a look at what could be in Governor Walker's budget tonight. And we'll have coverage of that budget address right here on the Ideas Network starting tonight at 7.
A new report out from an international team of researchers finds some potentially troubling news for the future of the planet. In recent years, the team devised a framework to monitor Earth's overall health based on what they call planetary boundaries. These are conditions in which human civilization can continue to thrive.
The team identified 9 of those boundaries. They say crossing them could generate abrupt or irreversible environmental changes. Here's where the bad news comes in. Civilization has already crossed 4 of them, and human activity is the culprit. That's creating plenty of questions for policymakers, and the report was discussed recently at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. So where do we go from here?
Joining us now is one of the researchers behind that report, Steve Carpenter. He's the director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Limnology and the only U.S.-based researcher in that study. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Veronica.
So how did the team come up with this idea, this concept of planetary boundaries, as you call them?
Well, we knew that something called the Great Acceleration is going on, and that's a rapid increase in human use of the planet's resources, faster than exponential increase in some cases. And that got us to thinking about, well, how far can you go? And the planetary boundaries were an attempt to answer that question.
So in other words, you're trying to draw the lines, show where the limits are.
We're not drawing the lines for the absolute limits. We're drawing the lines for the danger zones. So I think of the planetary boundaries as like the curb between the sidewalk and the street. You really don't want to spend a lot of time wandering around in the street. It would be better to stay on the other side of the curb. The curb is the planetary boundary. You cross it and something bad could happen.
And as far as what they are, what are the 9 planetary boundaries?
Well, they include things like phosphorus and nitrogen, which are used in fertilizers and some other industrial products. We are over the planetary boundaries for use of both nitrogen and phosphorus. Another example is species extinctions, losing the fabric of life that supports us all. And we are experiencing very rapid extinction rates and very rapid losses of species, the most rapid rates seen since we became a species ourselves. So that's very concerning. Some examples of other boundaries that are kind of getting close to the edge but haven't tipped over yet are climate change and land use change. We are very close to being in danger from those. Then, on the other hand, there are some boundaries that seem okay. One is fresh water use. We are not yet in great danger from fresh water use. Of course, there are very dry parts of the world where the situation is riskier than it is here in Wisconsin.
When you say fresh water use, do you mean over-consuming it?
Yes, that's correct. About 70 to 75% of our fresh water use is for irrigation in agriculture, and the remainder is for industrial uses or municipal use, like drinking water or watering our lawns, that sort of thing. And for the planet as a whole, we're okay with fresh water right now. Of course, there are extremely dry areas. Wisconsin is not one of those. And then there are other boundaries where we don't really know. We haven't done enough analysis yet. For example, ocean acidification, exotic toxic chemicals are two boundaries that we think need some attention, but we don't know whether we're over them yet.
Now, of those nine, and you mentioned some that we have either crossed or are in the danger zone, which one is the one that's really calling out to you, that's got the flashing red warning light on it right now?
Well, phosphorus is the one that I would point to, and phosphorus is a huge issue in Wisconsin. The phosphorus cycle is the mineral cycle of Earth that has been altered the most by human activity, so it's the most transformed. And excessive use of phosphorus leads to severe water pollution problems. It leads to blooms of toxic cyanobacteria, which produce chemicals that are very harmful to people, livestock, and pets. And it makes using that water very, very expensive. It costs a lot of money to clean it up. And in Wisconsin, we have massive pollution problems due to phosphorus, particularly in some of the intensive agricultural regions of the state. So phosphorus is a problem that hits close to home.
How easy is it to remedy that particular one? You know, here in Wisconsin, you mentioned it is a problem. We're also a big ag state. So how do farms address this issue?
Well, one thing we can do is cut back on our fertilizer use, particularly for soils that are rich in phosphorus already, which includes quite a few of Wisconsin agricultural soils. The second thing we can do is develop better mechanisms for treating manure. Manure is a major vehicle for carrying phosphorus into our waterways. And frankly, that's an area where I think we need new technology. We need ways of treating the manure to remove the phosphorus and prevent the problem.
So when you talk about making changes like these, there needs to be consciousness of the problem and there needs to be a cord around finding a solution. Are we there yet when it comes to phosphorus?
Well, clearly not, or the problem would be solved. And there is discussion almost every year about phosphorus in Wisconsin. And some areas of the state are doing better than others. For example, in the Yahara watershed around Madison, there are some very innovative phosphorus management programs that are getting started. They're very small, but if they work, they could be scaled up. But I think that as far as phosphorus goes in Wisconsin, we are talking about it, but we haven't really taken the tough action that's necessary to solve the problem.
Now, once a boundary is crossed, something like phosphorus, for example, you listed nine of them, what happens?
Well, in the case of phosphorus, the danger is that we would go into runaway algae blooms in some lakes and rivers, and there are places around the world where that's occurred. If we go quite a bit further with phosphorus than we have so far, we could turn the oceans anaerobic, which has happened in the past, and so all the fish die. And
what does anaerobic mean again?
No oxygen. So there's no oxygen in the oceans, and that's not likely to happen anytime soon.
So that's very bad.
That's really bad. We definitely don't want that to happen, but we will lose all the fresh water before we lose the oceans. So that's going to be pretty bad, too.
Any success stories where we have approached one of these boundaries and humankind has been able to dial it back?
The best known one is the ozone hole, where the ozone hole was discovered in the 1970s. By the mid-1980s, industry and governments had agreed on a technological fix on substituting different chemicals for the ozone harming chemicals. So we replaced the chlorofluorocarbons that destroyed ozone with other chemicals that do not. And the world is on track to repair the ozone hole within a few decades. Of course, it is very slow. But the important thing is that there was an international agreement about this problem, that we need to solve it, and effective action was taken.
And as we wrap up, what has the reaction been to this? Has it been positive, what you hoped for?
Well, there's been tremendous interest, and we're very happy to have that interest. I'm also very happy that the media have not treated this like an end of the world gloom and doom story. They've treated it as a problem that we need to get together and solve. So I think that the reception that I have heard is very constructive.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Steve Carpenter, director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Limnology. He's part of an international research team that's developed the concept of planetary boundaries and which ones humans have already crossed. According to numbers out last month from the National Center for Children in Poverty, 44% of U.S. children live in low-income families, and about one in every five live in poor families. Meanwhile, there's an ongoing debate over the impact of single-parent families as compared to two-parent families.
But how do things like poverty and family structure play out in the day-to-day world of parenting? A new report uses census data to try to figure out the answer and how we're doing on some of the basics of positive parenting. Sandra Hofferth is with us now. She's a professor of family science at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. She's the author of this new report on parenting. It was published by the Council on Contemporary Families. Sandra, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, let's start with the parenting behaviors we're trying to measure here. What are some of the indicators that you're looking at?
The Census Bureau report looked at couple of very critical measures, including reading to children, eating breakfast or dinner together as a family, having clear rules regarding television viewing, and facilitating children's participation in extracurricular activities. And these are key measures in terms of children's later long-term emotional and cognitive health, particularly reading to children is associated with their being prepared for school. Eating breakfast helps communication between parents and children, as well as, of course, nutrition. Having rules that pediatricians recommend that children not watch more than 2 hours of television a day. And then extracurricular activities are very important for children's later, their grades in school, their social lives, and eventually possibly getting accepted at college and going to college.
Now, these seem like little things, you know, a breakfast here, a storybook there, but they add up?
Absolutely. One of the most important findings in developmental psychology is that the communication, the amount of communication, the number of words that between parents and children is critical for their development of language. The more words they hear, for example, psychologists have compared highly educated parents and the words to their children, and then less educated parents, and find there's a big difference in just even the amount of language, and that's critical for children's development of syntax, being able to read, write, and be successful in school.
Now, the overall findings is, it sounds like we're doing pretty well. There are a lot of questions, as we said up front, about, single-parent families versus two-parent families. But the big finding in your report seems to be that's not so much the big deal as income, people in poverty versus everybody else.
Yes, there is a lot of concern in the country about whether children would do well in two-parent families versus single-parent families. And so at the beginning of the report, the authors certainly looked at compared families with two parents compared to families with headed by a single parent, mostly the mother. They found some small differences, but in some cases they were like reading one time a week. For example, if two parents read seven times a week and single parents six times, there might be some differences, but they're very small. The differences were not large, and most parents know what they're supposed to be doing with their children, for example, reading to them. Most parents had rules for their children on media, and for the most part, they ate breakfast or dinner with their children. But there was one area in which there were some interesting differences, and if we look at extracurricular activities, that's for older children, say in the early teen years. There was a difference of 10 percentage points between, say, a family with two parents and a family with one parent, between 33 or 34% and 24%. However, when they divided it by poverty, they found that the families that were well off, say, 200% of poverty, 44% of their children were in extracurricular activities, and only 22% of children who were in families below the poverty level. So there was a much larger percentage difference by income compared with family structure.
And was that true on a lot of these indicators, reading to kids, meals together, that sort of thing? Did those kind of differences persist by income?
Well, you have to remember that income and family structure are highly confounded. And that is, for a two-parent family, only 14% are in poverty. Whereas if you look at a single-parent family, 41% of those families are poor. So in a sense, you're confounding family structure and income, and you can't really sort it out, just one variable at a time. But I think I have done some analysis looking at these variables simultaneously, and there I continue to find that income and education, things linked with income, remain very important in what parents do with children and in children's later outcomes. Some of the family structure measures just decline substantially. But I think there's one interesting finding that the report also included families with two parents, but they were not married. So these were the two biological parents. They just hadn't gotten married yet, and that is happening a lot today. So they will go ahead and have a child, and they maybe later on get married, but they're not yet married. And those families are more like the single parents, the single mother families, in terms of some of these indicators. They're less likely to read to children on a regular basis. They have much lower levels of participation in extracurricular activity among their children. And those families, 37% are poor. So on the basis of that, I came to the conclusion that it really is more the income of the family rather than the number of parents.
And this, you point out in writing about this, that this is a big deal in part because many children, one in five by some measures, are living in poverty in the United States. So if this is a big cohort, not getting these kind of parenting behaviors.
Absolutely. And I point out that it's as many as 26%, one in four of the very youngest children are in families that are below the poverty line. And most psychologists and developmental psychologists, economists, most people believe that the early years are critical to get children exposed to language, to get them the advantages that middle-class families have, but particularly for things like communication. It's a higher percent, and there is a recent report that came out that suggested in public schools, almost half of the children in public schools today are low income, that is, at free or reduced price lunch. So it's a tremendous problem in the United States if there are these gaps by income and what parents do with children.
Well, stepping a bit beyond the report you wrote and looking at what we know about how families work, why are these differences? Is it a case that the low-income families don't know about these positive parenting practices, or they know, but they don't have the time, the resources to participate in these things?
That's an excellent question. Well, take a look at, I think one comparison would be eating meals with children, and another one would be extracurricular activities. On the extracurricular activities, there we find that some of those activities do require resources, even though there are many activities at public schools, after-school activities, clubs, that don't cost anything. When you look at lessons, there's a cost to that. For sports, many times there might be equipment, there would be fees that are involved. It might be costs in a traveling team. So these are not, for the most part, they're not totally costless. I think sports was one of the areas where there was the biggest difference between higher income and low income families. On the other hand, when they looked at eating dinner with parents, there they found that in some cases children of single parents were more likely to be eating dinner at home. And so there's a case in which there might be an advantage, and we suspect that that's because it's linked to the lesser likelihood of their children being in extracurricular activities, because once you have children in several different activities, you might be eating shifts on dinner and not being able to eat together every night. So we think that those two are linked together. There are differences depending on the type of activity, but I would say that because most of the parents said they were they were reading to children 6 days a week at least, that most parents know that these are good and they should be involved with their children reading, having rules. 90% of parents said they had rules for the children regarding television. Most of them did eat breakfast with their children. So parents do know that these are the things, but they can't always afford them or do them in practice.
We're talking to Sandra Hofferth from the University of Maryland, looking at a new study on parenting in the United States, what positive parenting looks like, and how things like the number of parents, single family, two-parent families, and family income can affect parenting.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. As a parent, are you or were you able to do some of these things to get your kids involved in sports, to read to them, to have meals together? And what obstacles stand in your way? Single parents, parents with lower income, share your experiences. What kind of challenges do you face? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with family science professor Sandra Hofferth with University of Maryland, talking about her new report on how we parent in the United States. Looking at census data, she checks out how parents are doing and what kind of impact things like the number of parents and family income have on parenting.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. We're hearing the big national numbers. You can bring a personal face to it at 800-642-1234. What do you think are the key things that make a difference in parenting, that day-to-day stuff? Is it reading to kids, the mealtime, getting your kids out and involved in activities? And what kind of roadblocks are there with your work, maybe being low income? Or if you're a single parent, what stands in the way of the things that you know are good for your kids? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Sandra, before we get to our callers, so we know, as you've said, that low-income families, obstacles for them, have a hard time doing some of these things that we know are good for kids. So I guess the next question is how to help, how to make a difference, how to get these positive parenting behaviors more common for these kids.
Yes, that's a great question. Well, there are a number of policy options that President Obama has proposed, expanding the earned income tax credit, increasing, one thing he could do is increase the child care credit. Right now there's a credit where parents can get a fraction of what they spend on child care. And any of these things would help improve family incomes so they might be able to afford the fees for children's extracurricular activities. They might be able to get an extra car, an extra vehicle, because there is a lot of shuttling children back and forth when they get to be older teenagers, to be able to get back and forth to work so that they would have the time. I'm looking at the numbers in Wisconsin. The average cost of infant care, for example, is $11,300 a year. That's for an infant. And that would be, depending if for a single parent, that would be almost half your income. For a two-parent family, it would be maybe 14%. The highest cost is in New York, which with about $14,000 a year, and the lowest is in Louisiana with $5,000. So if you go to a four-year-old in Wisconsin, the cost of child care is $9,000 for full-time care. And this is the average annual cost, I guess, across both center and family child care, about $9,000. So that's a lot of money. And anything to help parents to afford that. And those would be good quality care, because in those situations, the provider is providing cognitive stimulation, reading to the children, and helping while parents are working.
Let's get to our callers. We've got Becky on the line with us in Madison. Becky, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for calling in.
What did you want to bring up, Becky?
I'm a single mom. I have my kids 24/7. My son's father's been incarcerated for 8 years. My youngest is 8. My oldest is 18. And I just wanted to talk about the constant stress that I feel. I'm politically active, and it's very depressing to see disearned income credit taken away, to see my son has dental coverage, but actually nobody will take it in Madison, so we had to drive an hour and a half north, and then we had a referral to Rhinelander, which is 7 hours away about, and so it just seems like, I mean, just for me to just keep my health in okay shape, because of the constant stress, I end up having digestive trouble and having all kinds of food allergies, and just it's just like the stress and the worry and never ends, because it's all me and I can't get sick, you know, and I'm low income, so I just wanted to say that.
Becky, thank you so much for sharing your experience. Sandra, a lot of work, a lot of stress being a single parent and being a low-income single parent in particular. How big a factor is it, do you think, in making it difficult to do a lot of these good things for kids?
Yes, I'm really sorry to hear that. That is quite a shame. I was wondering, is your child doing fine in school, and does he have after school care that can help and give you some relief as well? Is there anything like that for you that would help?
Becky?
Yes. Thankfully, he's in the school system at Madison. It's a very good school. And he's doing well. He's in the 99th percentile. He's very intelligent. He's especially good in math. But he's late to school several times a week because I'm just not able to get, you know, just the constant cycle of demand about work and food and, you know, bed and everything. I don't read to him at night. It's been a great regret of mine because I did always want to do that, but I just find us to be totally exhausted.
Becky, thanks a lot, and good luck to you and your kids. I want to get on to some more callers, Sandra, so let's go to Melody in Mercer. Melody, hi.
Hi. I just, you know, to kind of piggyback on, you know, being tired, it's really hard to not be frustrated, and it's really hard to find the energy to just find enjoyment and appreciation for your children, because you're usually just annoyed. You don't want to be, but you are.
Melody, and are you in a situation where you're a single parent or working in a low income in your family?
I was for many, many years, but now I'm a working mom with two other children, and I do have a husband, and he's wonderful and helped tremendously, but you're still a mom and three kids and working, and you actually want to try to enjoy your kids, but you're just so tired this time.
Melody, thanks a lot. So tired, hard to be the positive parent we want to be all the time, Sandra.
Yes, but it sounds as though you do have some time for your children. You can talk at the dinner table. It sounds as though, that unfortunately is what raising children does involve sometimes. But it sounds as though your kids are doing well. Is that right in the school system?
Melody?
So far, so good. We don't actually eat at the dinner table ever. I'm a nurse, so I work at all. Various shifts all the time, but you know, we try to like give as many hugs and kisses and as much good food as possible, but that's basically it. You know, you just try to give a hug, try to give a kiss, but sometimes you're just yelling and
Melody, thanks a lot for the call. Sandra, again, nationwide, a lot of people nurses, retail workers, restaurant workers have those shifts where they just can't be at mealtime predictably? Is there any substitute for the benefits that provides?
Well, certainly, if one parent can, there might be one parent there. It doesn't have to be both parents in any case, but just to sit down, or even in the car when you're taking the child to school, or any time at all, just to chat about things. I think just the language, just communicating, that's really more important than reading to children. It could be, and so it's just keeping the communication going is important. I think as far as any activities you can do, the other thing would be try and make sure that you can find good quality after school care for the children, and make sure that in those settings the children are talking with the caregivers and reading and doing activities in those programs. That's really, really important. And when I pointed out the cost of care, I think anything that could help provide funds for parents, and particularly the increase in the child care tax credit, would be helpful, because, as I say, with the cost in Wisconsin of being $9,000 a year for a four-year-old, and the most you can get back is $1,000. If you spend $3,000, you get a third back. That anything to help parents would be wonderful and would make, I think, all of these mothers much happier.
Sandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. Best wishes to everybody, and thank you for sharing your stories.
That's Sandra Hofroth, professor of family science at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. We've got the report we've been talking about, a summary linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Today is the anniversary of a sad day in music history. It's the day the music died.
On this day in 1959, a plane carrying Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper crashed in Iowa. The singers were in the midst of a Midwest tour that had started the previous month in Milwaukee, and they were on their way to the next show in Minnesota.
Well, we lost a lot of potential music. They did all leave us with great music. Ritchie Valens was known best for his version of the Mexican folk song La Bamba. The Big Bopper, J.P. Richardson, for his song Chantilly Lace. And Buddy Holly for a string of hits, including That'll Be the Day, Peggy Sue, and Not Fade Away.
And I think, unless I'm very much mistaken, that the song American Pie references maybe a bunch of other things, but also I think this day.
Yeah, that, and I think that's where that phrase, the day the music died, came from, or at least was popularized.
We'll go out to the news with Buddy Holly and Ray Vaughn here on Central Time.
Oh,